21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus. She's a worried owl, walking down this same highway. I don't see nothing new, but I feel a lot of change. And I get the strangest feeling as I'm heading for the light.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. This is Dr. Bob Hieronymus and my executive producer, research assistant, Laura Cordner. And our engineer is Noah Dankner. Well, it was late 1966, and I was cooling off in my bathtub looking at one of the last dollar bills I owned when I realized that the pyramid, an eye in a triangle, was a symbol of America that I needed to know more about. And to make a very, very long and frustrating story short, when I contacted the State Department for its meaning, they had no answer. I was furious. It was the reverse side of America's Great Seal, our State Department seal, and they didn't know its meaning. Well, unfortunately, I gave them hell time and time again, but to no avail. So, I did my own research, and by 1973, I thought I knew all about it. And by 1974, I had published my first book, The Two Great Seals of America. And I was an extremely happy camper then. Until I learned that the Freemason William Barton I had thought was the designer of the seal's reverse was not the actual William Barton who designed the Great Seal. I was crushed. And embarrassed. So, I revised the Two Great Seals of America in 1976. And I was happy that President Ford wrote it. As a matter of fact, he sent me a letter about it. However, but even that had a few errors. I needed to do more primary research, and it took me over 5 years to complete my doctoral dissertation, in which I had to confess my errors and drop the theory that the Great Seal was created by Freemasons, even though my heart told me there was some secret society behind it and its symbolism. But I couldn't prove it. Well, here it is, 2014. And since 2005, I've been doing scores of interviews with the History Channel, National Geographic, Discovery Channels. I mean, scores of these channels. And also Russian television, German television, Canadian television. And my books were now published in French, Spanish, German, Russian, Japanese. By the way, you never saw any of my books ever reviewed in Maryland, in Baltimore. Nope, not here. You know, I was battling the fundamentalists and conspiratorialists who were making the same errors I did in 1974 and 1976. In 2011, I interviewed Gary Giannotti on 21st Century Radio. He had some important insights into our nation's Great Seal, and by 2013, he presented me his theory that it was not just William Barton and Secretary of State Charles Thompson who designed the Great Seal. I thought, well, how in the hell is that possible? Well, I have been reviewing Gary Giannotti's research and have found his theory is credible. And if so, he deserved the right to present his theory, and he is joining us for the first 1.5 hours on 21st Century Radio, and our last segment will be spent with our very dear friend, Janie Hendricks, Jimi Hendrix's sister and now CEO of Experience Hendrix. You see, I shared what I knew about America's Great Seal in 1968 with her brother, Jimi Hendrix, as well as Ziggy Marley, the Lovin' Spoonful, and scores of other rockers. Now, for the first time anywhere on planet Earth, you will hear that there is even a greater mystery about this symbol that no one else ever discussed, and you are privileged to learn it from the man who has sought it out at great expense of time, energy, and money. Gary Giannotti is joining us to present his research into the genealogical history of some of America's founders that raises questions like these. was the rejected proposal for the obverse of America's Great Seal created by William Barton, as tradition teaches, or was it created by Robert Scott, the Scottish-born American engraver who worked on the United States Great Seals? Giannotti will demonstrate how the Scott family is directly associated to the families of the Knights Templar by marriage, and says he did not come to America to win the respect of the Founding Fathers in order to get the job of making the United States seals. Giannotti claims that Scott was trained and sent to the United States to do the job as part of the secret influence of his families, also known as the Unknown Superiors, who were secret Jacobites exiled from Scotland. Now, what role did Scotland and the Templars play in the founding of America and the design of America's Great Seal? Welcome back to 21st Century Radio, Gary.
How are you? Thank you for having me back.
Well, I'm awfully glad to have you back. As you know, you may have to return a few more times for us to get to the bottom of this great mystery. So we need to get started right away. Now, the 1783 Second Great Seal is the oldest U.S. surviving government seal. Can you tell us about it?
Yes, I can. A few years back, I was asked for my public service work as a researcher, giving information to historical societies and museums. The National Museum of the American Revolution, 501c3 group at Washington Cross and State Park, where Washington crossed to Delaware. That's where they headquarter a collection, the Swan Historical Foundation. I was asked by the founder to if I would join his board of trustees for the work that I had done in helping him with some other relics. And I gladly took the position, and in that process, he asked me to study a relic that he believed was the most important relic in the collection. And it was about the size of a smaller than a half dollar, a great seal, one that I've never seen in anything except for the type of work being done by Scott and his associate, the famous artist James Trenchard. And it got me thinking. I had a few years of research on this type of history in the past, and basically I took on this study because I'm able to find information on many relics and things that the average academic or PhD isn't able to, and that's just hardcore in the trenches and finding information, and that's my special gift. So basically, a couple years of study and research went on this piece. And basically, it became a relic for the United States that I consider to be the Rosetta Stone of Great Seals because of the information that it provides.
What kind of information does it provide?
A great deal of information, where when you study the relic, you can find microscopic artwork in three dimension up to a couple thousand images. You look at one little image of caricatures, little cartoon faces, and many, many different maker's marks where students, you could tell that students and different individuals left their maker's marks fairly small that you could see with a loop, and high-resolution images, you can bring them up and see them. And an amazing thing is that these men had a skill where you would see a caricature, say like a cartoon face, and then letters drawn off of it. And you would look at it, and you'd see a face. And you would turn it on a quarter turn, and that image would turn into another face. And you keep doing that process on each quarter turn. And different images emerge. Out of many comes one, or out of one comes many. It's in the whole sense of what you hear about the history. And basically, I started studying and doing the matching up the maker's marks with known works of the famous artists of Philadelphia. And over a period of time, everything started to match up to all the different works of these unknown men that aren't really given the credit for doing all of this work on all the government seals.
Now, why, Gary, why would those who engrave these other things on the seal, why would they do that?
Their maker's marks, most
yeah.
people?
Well, not just the maker's marks, but the actual faces and other things that you find on it. And I especially like the way you describe this in regards to, say, for instance, the various American flags to determine authenticity and things like that.
Exactly. The main thing with a lot of this artwork that you see in microscopic is really, when it's impressed into the paper, it leaves an impression, and some of these bigger caricatures or even these maker's marks show exposed. And that is to represent a way of showing, I'm the President of the United States, and I'm sending a letter overseas, and I'm the diplomat that wants to make sure that this is not a counterfeit letter. And so that type of marking is really a type of anti-counterfeiting device. And that's a device that was placed on ancient documents for sovereign documents of governments or royals for hundreds of years, that style. And that was done in seals, coins, art, paintings, weapons, documents, where they pressed them, even in flags, historical flags in silk. They painted this into the art also. And it really signifies also government possession, if it's done in a flag also, but also There is information left inside of these symbols of some relics that you do see. Not all of them, but there is.
Well, I find this to be truly amazing, because my reason for saying that is that when you knew Benjamin Franklin and you knew his concerns over our money system, you know, he was so deeply involved in trying to make sure that forgeries were not going to abound. He was always looking for ways of doing this. And it seemed to me, of course, some of the ideas that I've read of his were just fine, but I didn't necessarily think they were sufficient. But this system that you're talking about, especially maker's marks, I do not know, Gary, I do not know any other source of information dealing with this field of knowledge. As we've talked about the Great Seal, I have never seen anyone else discuss the possibility of markers or any of this other. As a matter of fact, they probably would poo-poo it if I even brought it up. So I think this is. Would you want to comment on that first, sir?
Yeah. Let me do that, please. You have to understand, this work is very complex. It's very hard to do. One person would be skilled, say, better in letters than the other. The other person in doing, say, the wings or a head figure, the microscopic work, another person, and or a lot of them. And so these artists had apprentices also. So it was a lot of work to make these. And so basically, one of the way for other artists in that field of ancient art was to be able to work a little section, leave their maker's mark with a couple of letters jumping off of each other's. And you will see this scattered out in every single seal that exists and every single work that they've ever done. And there's dozens, up to a dozen or two, in every single work that they do. And it's consistent in dozens and dozens and dozens of prints and maps and art pieces that they've worked on, weapons and engraving cannons, and paintings that they made, believe it or not. And you can clearly see it all. And it's amazing. It's an amazing art that has been lost to society.
Well, how did you find out about this, Gary?
Well, my eyes were going funny one day when I really started studying the seal and high-definition images. And I started looking at better images, that working to acquire higher-grade images to see this art. And basically, it clearly was able to be seen in some of these works. And then I started doing the research all in high-definition images of every type of relic out there that exists and started seeing them, not every type, but many relics in this field that they worked on. And here's the art. It became I found an art that's been lost. But this art goes back a couple thousand years. This goes in coins, of ancient coins, ancient jewelry, ancient armor. This is an art that's been around. This is the type of stuff that you see in it's the Mona Lisa, right? The famous Italian great artist. This art exists, and it was passed down from master teacher to their apprentice student, and this has been passed down for generations upon generations upon generations.
So what this would mean is that several artists worked on each seal, and they maybe three, four or so.
On an average, three or four, yes.
And in that way, you could get, and you also make a wonderful case on how many things they had to do and how long it took them to do this. And that's the reason why it was like, I guess, in a certain sense, a small army of individuals who were concerned about our country, its future, and how to preserve it. Because secrecy, in many of these cases, was enormously important. So congratulations, Gary. You know, I think this is, of course, just the beginning of it.
Oh, it is. It is, because now we're finding this art in other European treasures, and now it's opening up a box for national treasures that are devalued, that now we can identify relics, which I've already done. I've been doing it on priceless relics, that people have lost their entire history of national treasures that we're re-identifying because of this study now.
We're going to take our first break of this hour. Our guest is Gary Giannotti. His genealogical research into some of America's founders that raises questions about the Great Seal and its connections to the Masons, the Knights Templar, and Scottish secret societies.
This is Billy Cox with Band of the Gypsies and the Jimi Hendrix Experience. You're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio with our guest Gary Giannotti and his geological research into some of America's founders that raises questions about the Great Seal and its connections to the Masons, Knights Templar, and Scottish secret societies. This seal, the 1783 Second Great Seal, the oldest U.S. surviving government seal, you note that the government refuses to police certain seals, or especially this particular seal, from Congress in the state of New Jersey. What can you tell us about that? I have a hard time understanding this.
Well, from day one, when I was working with the Swan Foundation, I basically had to learn the laws associated, because these are sovereign relics. And the basic laws are that no one is allowed, other than Congress or the government, to possess one of these historical relics. And basically, I had contacted everybody and in the government and learning and requesting help. And there had been some help, and there had been a lot of disappointments and a lot of refusals, laughter at me from the State Department, from specific individuals, members of ICE who actually yelled at me. These are the people that go after international treasures that are from foreign countries here. They police them, but they don't police our national treasures, or they don't have laws pertaining to doing anything. And it just became very confusing and frustrating and wanting to make me very angry about knowing the laws and the facts. And basically, in this situation with having such an important relic, what I had realized was that this relic had been stolen from the embassy in Spain in 1939. And this would still fall into the laws of this international UNESCO laws with trafficking of antiquities. And basically, the whole thing was that here's a good group of people, and they're making it harder for me to work with them, because I had asked them to go direct to the government and ask them, and with me, to request permission to have possession rights, caretaker rights, because no one's allowed to own a United States federal government seal. These are used for the United States government on documents, and it's only for governments. Mm-hmm. And that's it, period. And official business. And it had been just one of the most challenging things that I've ever dealt with in my life. And I've had a government agent, an ex-CIA or FBI guy, tell me to my face on the phone, specifically that, what if the government doesn't want it back? What are you going to do? I told him. I told him the T word, you know, the treason word, you know, and I got upset. I was kind of taken back and shocked. Mm-hmm. But I kept going forward, and I just have not stopped, and I'm not going to stop. And I had told this board of directors to please address this with the government, because you have to have some sort of a possession right. And they believe that years ago, 30 years ago, the famous Berger, Justice Berger, had given them permission to keep this relic because they had loaned it back to the United States State Department for a display. Mm-hmm. And basically, a justice has no right. Only Congress is allowed to give permission.
Oh, I see.
Nobody else but Congress is allowed to give permission for anyone to possess a relic of such. And basically, the group had gotten pretty upset with me and shunned me, pushed me aside. And basically, every time I requested to do some work and present information at one of these big shows they were going to do, they blackballed me and cut me off. And I was really shocked about it, because I had put 2 years of work into it at that time and had a good understanding of what this history was. And basically, because they weren't going to go forward and learning the laws, basically it put them in a criminal position. And that's where they stand right now, unless they give this relic up.
So they do not want the public knowing that this survives?
I wouldn't say that. They've had it on display.
Also,
they're promoting for years, but mm-hmm. they're promoting something, or they're not even promoting it. It's just on display. It has a little image, and that's it. They're not really. They put it on the internet too, but they just never knew what it was, and they just twist the story. It's not stolen.
Does this allow them to control a certain history that they may not want out of the box?
By them, giving an example, by them controlling this history where they didn't go full all out to great seal historians such as yourself and other people and track you down, what has happened is it has done great damage to the preservation or the learning of this history. It set us back 30 years, and if this history was better understood and brought to the public, like out to the public to know it existed completely, mm-hmm. there may never have been conspiracy history with the Illuminati and all that poppycock that we hear about.
Yeah, we sure do hear about it a lot. Now let's talk a little bit about the man of the hour, so to speak, Robert Scott. He is identified as the head great seal and seal maker of the United States. Would tell us about this man, please.
Well, this man was born in 1745 at the time of the last Great War, the War of the 45, the 1745, the last shot that the Scottish had the opportunity to win the throne of power back from the English. And prior to that, this war had been going on for 100 years, roughly. And the king, the Scottish kings, which were the Stuart families, were exiled into France and Italy, back and forth there. And they had several wars to restore this power. And in 1745, they launched the war out of Canongate, Scotland. And basically, my belief is that there's no question it was associated to this history of Robert Scott and his father with his Masonic Lodge, where they had launched this last attempt to win the throne back. And Robert, there was so little, almost nothing known of this man. Nothing. He comes to America, the United States, or America, 1775. He's in Virginia doing anti-counterfeiting measures on bank money. That's what he was trained for also. And basically, he's an enigma. No one knows anything about him, and nothing about his family. Nothing existed in this country on him. Just very few things about his art, him working at the mint, portraits and prints and some things that his work that he had done, but not anything about him personally and who he was. And I started doing a lot of legwork, and I was able to put one and one together and start doing research with the people in Scotland on these names. And there was information associated that Robert was a watchmaker and he was a crafted, skilled artist, and that his father was a George Scott. And with this research, I was able to contact a lodge that had a founding master in 1745 named George Scott. And by chance, one of the most wonderful persons I ever met in my life, who's now recovering from a heart attack and illness, Mr. Ron McCandless, is the historian to Robert Scott's Father's Lodge. And since 1780s, or actually since 1745, no one knew the identity of who he was, the founding master of their lodge. Nobody. And my information allowed him to find information that was never found before. And we nailed it down, and we found out who Robert Scott's father was. And then there was another enigma after him, and we found out who his father was, and then who that person's father was that came to America in 1685, an exiled religious dissenter, and founded New Jersey. Think about it. Robert Scott's father, great-grandfather, founded East New Jersey, where this whole seal and situation that I've been dealing with for some time is located. And what has been learned about this family is that a lot of them, after into the great-grandfathers, are so well documented, and they're recognized as one of the most powerful border clan families in all of Scottish history. And this family traces all the way back into the 1300s as one of these head families, very close for 500 years at the top in the government, the head of chancery. Which is the head of the courts, head of the government there, and also the head of the privy councils. These are titles given to the family. Privy council being that the king's personal advisor at the highest levels. And this relationship with the Stuart family, this dynasty, was a very tight bond that was then learned that it was by blood, this relationship, for 500 years. This was the family that adopted the first surname Scott. And there had been a great deal more work done recently, and we, myself and some of my associates overseas that have helped me with some of this, the Flemings, and a DNA specialist out in New Zealand, Gail, and we've been working on this whole big project now, because what had happened was I found documents from an ancient church called Kelso Abbey, and this information, and in Molay, this Battlemore, a place called Molay, and this area was settled by these ancient royals, and there was information found that a man named Anselm of Molay was the father of a Richard Scott, and not the traditional documented history that was always done by the great academics forever. And there was basically another Richard after this Richard, and then before that, then there was a Uhtred, the ancient name right there. And so these documents had unveiled a history of this ancient family that they were not from the male line Scottish, but Normans. And this is a major genealogical discovery for the history of Scotland. I mean, this is big time, because this is the family that adopted the first time that here's the surname for Scott for Scotland. Mm-hmm. And the maternal lines of this family are the ancient royal families from the ancient Skoti, the invaders of Scotland, the Scythians, and ancient families that had ruled for hundreds of years. These ancients, and that connect history going back to Persia and the Garden of Eden and parts of Turkey, and also the marriage of actually a pharaoh's daughter. And a lot of people say it's not true, but a lot of the history with the ancient scholars believe it is real. It is true that this is the founding history of Scotland, where the name comes from. The ancient daughter of Akhenaten, which is Skoda. Princess Skoda, and she had married a Scythian prince, and they settled over in Spain and fought their way and conquered Great Britain. And their sons later adopted the name, or the Skodi, they call them Skodi, and that's the name of Scott, one of the variations, the first variations of the name Scott. And this name being used for the first time was done by the Great Seal Maker's family, going all the way back to the 1100s. And now we can trace back the family to two more parents, a couple more grandparents, back to Rouen, France, the Flemings. And this is the family that was the champion of William the Conqueror. And also the name Fleming is associated with Flanders and Flanders, mm-hmm. and the lowlands of Holland and those parts of France, these ancient families. And there's a lot of new theories to who the families are. And one of them is believed that the most ancient family is to a king named Martel of France, one of the Franks. Could be. It's fingers could point to him. And if you know anything about masonry, Bob, Freemasons, this was the man, the royal, that brought over the Masons, stonemasons, and the ancient knowledge in Freemasonry to France and to England.
Mm-hmm. Now back to John Scott here. This is really Robert Scott, sorry.
Robert?
But yeah, because there is a John.
there's a lot of them in the family.
Yes, I know there certainly is. So there was some ultimate purpose in Scott's, the secrecy about Scott, and his work in coming to the United States and working on our I guess you would say, he worked on our banking system?
He worked on our banking system, absolutely. Relatives of the families in Scotland, they created the Banks of Scotland. His teacher was also, his father was an artist and also was his teacher. And they were also involved in the banking system and making the money for England, too, after just prior to the end of the American Revolution, right at the beginning and after.
And there might be some relationship to where Alexander Hamilton was heading in regards to the ideas of this particular group?
Absolutely. Hamilton's family were ancient royals, very important lords. They were well connected at the top with these families to the treasuries and to major government institutions back then. And his idea, he was abandoned by his father, who was one of these very important from the ancient families, royal families. Lords. And basically, here he was in the United States, and when he got involved with the Treasury there, being appointed, he adopted the ideas from Lord Hume, H-U-M-E. And this Lord Hume was also an educator, a philosopher. And so it's the economics with philosophy that they used to create the U.S. Treasury. Everything was based on that system in the early days. And basically, Benjamin Franklin was almost, he was best friends with this man. He became very close friends with this man.
It would make very good sense, because Benjamin Franklin was always looking for ways to protect the country from falling a prey to individuals that could eliminate our money system by dumping in phony money. I mean, that could destroy us. It could destroy any country like that. But we need to take our final break of this hour. When we return, let's move towards the conspiracy secrecy relating to the Jacobites and the banking system establishment, because that's what I understand about the Templars. That's really what they were mostly all about from that standpoint. Is that correct, sir?
All about the money back then. They sure were.
We'll be back with our guest, Gary Giannotti. His genealogical research into some of America's founders that raises questions about the Great Seal and its connections to the Masons, the Knights Templar, and the Scottish Secret Societies. If this is correct, then we have an awful lot of other research that needs to be done to understand just how important this material is.
Hi, this is Janie Hendricks, sister of Jimi Hendrix, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
And Janie will be rejoining us somewhere around 9:30, somewhere close to that. Our guest is Gary Giannotti, and we're talking about some, well, from my perspective, this is enormously important, because having done battle over the last 40 years with people who keep trying to tell me that America is satanic and that kind of thing, is something I'd like to try to straighten out with these folks. But unfortunately, when they have entire, when they have certain networks, let's put it that way, networks that love to push this stuff in a negative way, it's almost impossible to stop them because it sells. It sells books that are worthless in many different ways. Does it sound like I'm biased, Gary?
No, not at all. Not at all.
Well,
not at all.
Yeah.
It's really the truth. You want to know the truth. And the one thing I'll say about you, Bob, is that you really did, to me, you set the foundation for the truth of this history. If it wasn't for people like you, I wouldn't even have bothered to have really gone all out and researched this. I mean, that's very special, Bob. And, you know, you're here now, and now we're going to have a chance for the first time in this country's history to understand what these relics and symbols and this history really means and what it represents to our freedom and sovereignty and where it originated and how far it goes all the way back to sovereign ancient families and where it came from. It's a new map. It's an open map of education to teach that has powerful facets that can be used now to save this country, to save treasures and relics, identity. It's going to be amazing. That's why this is so powerful, and this is what I love and I want to share with the people of this country.
Well, thank you, because I really appreciate that on many different levels. Now, the Templars, and what do they have to do with banking systems?
Well, they were the ones, these monks, warrior monks, that basically they would receive money from people going to Jerusalem, and then when they would get, without having to carry money, where it was dangerous to go from Europe to Jerusalem, they would get there and have their note in Jerusalem, and then they would be able to redeem their money, and so basically for a small fee, and that's how this all started amongst them with money, and you know, the art of making money has been around a long, long time, and we're fortunate now because we get to see who these families are, tracing it from that time period, that are directly related to all of these important families directly at the highest levels, to the treasuries and who ran them, and right to their families that were the royals, all of them.
So what about the Jacobites? Who are they, and how did they get involved in any of this?
Well, basically you had the ruling class families of Scotland, the rightful heirs of the UK, okay? That's who they were, the rulers of Scotland, England, and Ireland from after the 1200s, this family, the Stuarts. Well, Robert Scott's direct grandfather, who used the first surname, his half-brother-in-law, his wife's half-brother, was the second High Steward. And this is the family where the kings of Scotland later became the Stuarts, the royal family of the kings of Scotland. And that steward, Alan FitzWalter, was the biggest supporter of the Knights Templar and their establishment. And there were royal families of these ancients of the UK that they were directly in the mix for establishing them to be there in Scotland. And now we're finding out that the other side of the family, where these Scots that were Flemings that adopted that name, there are connections with their direct families of royal lines that were involved as being people who were the kings of Jerusalem. And this is factual history. So William the Conqueror's wife, her father was Baldwin, and these are the families that were the kings of Jerusalem and the Count of Flanders. Flanders and Fleming have the same names and origins, association. So we have this connection here, but with the royal families connected to Scott's maternal lines, they were the ones that allowed this of the Templars to be established in Scotland and England. And that's the major connection right there. And then there was the intermarriage of many of these other families in combination. And so with the Jacobites, these ruling families that were Templars, they die out in supposedly in the 1500s, 1580s, I believe, with John Claverhouse, the first Viscount Dundee, Bonnie Dundee. And this man is documented as being Robert Scott's great-grandfather. That was his great-grandfather's son-in-law. And he was supposed to be the last Grand Master of the Templars that had died on the battlefield. And on this battlefield in 1689, around his neck, he had his Templar symbolism and also, I believe, the shirt with the cross that goes over his armor.
Mm-hmm.
And this connection was never picked up in the connection of these families. And it's hard. It's very hard research. But it's apparently documented. And so they die out, and then you have the hospital knights are there, the knights, the hospital knights of St. John, right?
Right.
And they're also connected directly to Robert Scott's families as well at the highest levels with the families of Calder, Sandilands. And James Sandilands was the first commander in Scotland in the 1500s. And basically there's this direct connection with Robert Scott's great-grandfather's family, his grandfather, grandparents. So then you have basically these families of Stuarts ruling for a long period of time, and then in the late 1600s, there's an internal family war. And one of the Stuart daughters and her husband from overseas there, another relative, they wind up kicking out the Stuart king and their families in their wars. And basically, they're exiled. And so the name Jacobite is in representation to it's with the Stuart name, in representation. And basically, they had a lot of battles, a lot of wars going to get this throne back and forth. And by the 1745, they tried to take the power back again. And so for 100 years, from the 1680s all the way through to the American Revolution, they were never, these ruling families were not in power. And they had secretly worked forever to, for those 100 years, to be able to get restoration back, and the last attempt was 1745. And so everything was in secrecy. It was in great secrecy with everything that they had done.
And how did America and our banking system and other things, how did this relate to what they were doing?
Well, basically, these direct families to Scott and his teacher and some of the circle of artists, they were involved in making the money and controlling the money and the heads of the banks themselves, mm-hmm. their families. I mean, they were the heads of the banks, right to the Drummond family. They were one of the big families of the banking system, too. And also the head of the treasury. And later on, that direct family of Scott's grandfather, great-grandfather, they're the ones that gave the money for the Rothschilds, for the for Paris, for the revolution, all the royal money. It's amazing, this connection. But basically, they were the skilled artists in this field. And it was very limited, the people that were doing this art. And so during the American Revolution, when Scott came here, he was involved in making the money of Virginia, and then by the 1790s at the Mint. But it was in such secrecy because basically if the English government knew what he was doing, there would have been repercussions on the families back in Scotland, mm-hmm. or even on him.
So that's why, in part, why that secrecy was absolutely necessary.
That was the major part of the secrecy that everyone believes is a conspiracy. Yeah, mm-hmm. it is a conspiracy. It's a Jacobite conspiracy, but it's out of fear for being killed. I mean, he was here. He was involved in bringing those secrets of how they made money, anti-counterfeiting devices, not just money, but also printing. Printing. He made the first encyclopedia. He was involved in it
mm-hmm.
in the United States. And maps and portraits of famous founding fathers, and He was an amazing artist, him and his students and his associates. But also, when he established working at the Mint in the 1790s, shortly after, James Trenchard, who is the other great seal maker, he was sent back to Rouen in France, and that's we had our government established over there, some of our government heads. And he was there involved in doing a lot of the government engravings for documents. But at the same time, I believe he was also involved in making money, and because Scott had a international money company.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people don't know much about that. But he was making international money for foreign countries while here and working at the Mint and doing work for everybody else. So he already had special permission because there were very, very few people skilled that were doing this work, and it was very, very valuable, especially if they drew a picture or an art scene. That's like watching TV today. That's all they had, mm-hmm. unless it was a painting. But as far as printing, it's very important. It's very rare, you know, very complicated art to do.
So today, when we're watching a series of shows dealing with the Founding Fathers and the Great Seal, and we get into a certain amount of conspiratorial history, they generally point to the Rothschilds being responsible for these terrible conspiracies of trying to take over the world. But in reality, it wasn't the Rothschilds that had the money. They were given the money.
They were given the money from the royal money from the treasuries, mm-hmm. In association to this Drummond family that was not exiled, still there. Mm-hmm. And this was money to be invested, and this invested money was the money that was supposedly used to fund the French Revolution.
Now, all of those things are extremely important, but we're coming up about the end of this hour. And friends, you can see why we need to look at this very carefully, because this theory has such enormous importance in regards to the way this planet has been evolving and the people on it. But when we return, we're going to go back to Robert Scott and take a look at some of the original Great Seal proposed designs. Go up to our website, 21stcenturyradio.com, where you can take a look at an important image that was developed what we thought was William Barton, but may not have been. It might have been created by Scott. That really is interesting from the perspective of maybe we don't really know who created these seals until now. We'll be back with our guest, Gary Giannotti, his genealogical research on America's founders. And I think it's going to take, quite a few shows to get to the bottom of all this.
Around the clock and breaking news now on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lisa Lissieri.
21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus and Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Look up your chimney, the sky ain't blue, it's kind.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. You're listening to the Traveling Wilburys. Never spend any time with those guys, but boy, I sure do like their harmonies. Almost as good as Crosby, Stills, and Nash and the Everly Brothers. Remember those guys? All right. My name is Dr. Bob Hieronymus. I'm a lowly PhD from somewhere around here. And our executive producer, who pushes me around like I'm a little rubber sponge, is Laura Kortner. That's because her father's a colonel, and she's used to being pushed around herself, so she knows how to push things around. And, of course, our engineer is Noah Dankner. And I understand that Noah Dankner has actually run under 4-minute mile. I think it was 3:22, something like that. He's fast, fast guy. All right. Now, our guest is Gary Giannotti. And it's we're talking about his primary genealogical research into some of America's founders that raises important questions about the Great Seal and its connections to the Masons or the Knights Templars and the Scottish secret societies and banking systems and that kind of thing. And I've told you, folks, are you sitting up straight? Are your feet flat on the floor? Are your eyes straight ahead? It's okay for you to chew gum, but you need to, when you go to your computer right now, you should have 21stcenturyradio.com and just take a look at our website, and you have a picture in Balmer, they call it a picture, of a very important symbol that I was directed to study by Gary some time ago. And after I did, because I didn't quite understand why he wanted me to study it, I learned a great deal. So that'll teach me about being patient and stuff like that. Gary, are you with us?
I'm there.
Okay. We have in front of us this design. I think this is from the second committee, which I thought this whole design was just rejected for one reason or other, because I thought it was William Barton that did this design. Tell us about this particular symbol and why you moved in another direction altogether in tracing its meaning and what it really was all about.
Well, there's a lot more to the images than meets the eye. And what I can definitely say that there is hidden art so sophisticated in those drawings that only a skilled engraver could have done that and made every one of the images that we know about, that we have, mm-hmm. has the exact artwork in it and in pretty much in the microscopic, very small detail. And there's a lot of it.
But well, before, Gary, before we get to all the details, tell us, let's describe what we have here.
Okay, what we have here is a white eagle. We have George Washington's actual 13-star flag design with the circle. We have the goddess to the left, and then we have a soldier on the right. But he's not just any soldier. And if you look at him and you know Scottish history, and you look at his hat and you see the white ribbon there, the white cockade, that's a Jacobite symbol right there. Mm-hmm. That's representation to the Bonnie Prince, who in that last war I told you about, that was a symbol to the Jacobite symbolism. And that's as clear as day.
Mm-hmm. He's holding a flute.
The man holding the flute, and that flute represented a famous Jacobite song that goes with that cockade. That's the purpose of that.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it represents, the song and the cockade with a song that goes with that history. Mm-hmm. It exists. It's pretty amazing. Yeah. And then what we do see is that we see a helmet. And on this helmet, there are upside down are what you would see that look like corporal and sergeant stripes. Well, that's Templar symbolism right there, but also symbolism going to the ancient crusading knights of these ancient families that they used, the chevron, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Then we see on top of the knight's, you know, helmet is a beehive, which represents a lot of the ancient symbolism going back to Egypt. And that's a lot of the ancient Skodi history I was telling you about, with the Scots and this ancient princess marrying the Scythian prince history there. So we see some of that history here. And then we see a very ancient symbol. We see a fire pillar, and we see a rising phoenix. And that fire pillar is a representation to the oldest religion going back to Persia and going back to where these Scythians and ancient families came from, which is Zoroastrian fire pillar symbolism. And when you look at this up close and you have this in high definition, you'll see symbolism in there written in letters. And there's a whole bunch of symbolism written in this thing. And then you have this rising phoenix. And a lot of the phoenix history, you see this in the Virginia seals that we know Scott made, even though they're missing and they don't exist for the first state seals. But a lot of this history that re-represents some of the families of the Templars and rising back to power. That's what it really represents, these families coming back to power again. And they did in the United States with a lot of the money system. And but really, a lot of it's to represent the ancient history of where it all comes from. Everything founded in the United States, it comes from these families. And they're families that sent the Templars that supposedly came here, which there's no question and a doubt that they did. They were here.
So this is our origins, goes back millennia.
Millennia, yeah.
Does it? So if you were interpreting this, but what I find most amazing to me is you, to the right side, I did not put this up on our website because we were running out of room there for a while, but we need to learn a little bit more about this fireplace that we see here.
And
yep. So would you describe this fireplace, where it is, and its importance?
Okay. Again, Robert Scott's great-great-grandfather, Sir John Scott of Scott-Starvet, he was one of the greatest academics in Scottish history. This was a great man who did great things, involved in the most important maps, education on the highest levels that you could imagine. This man was the top academic that you could probably say he's one of the greatest academics that ever lived in the history. So this family has this brilliant genetics with DNA for being very smart, and especially like with Robert. Robert was a type of Albert Einstein with the mathematics from his teaching. But this symbolism that you see with that pillar, in Sir John's tower, this small castle tower that still exists today, we see his marriage symbolism cut in stone. And what we see is his wife's name and his name, Sir John's, and some symbolism of Scottish and French symbolism. And then we see a Trinity, the Holy Trinity, like how you see the eye of the Trinity, or the eye, the great seal eye, and the triangle. But in this triangle, we see the same exact fire pillar with the same fire pillar with the rising phoenix, which cannot be mistaken by Barton or anybody even knowing or having knowledge of this, unless Robert Scott put that in there. This is from his direct family's fireplace, and it's a representation to the intermarriage of these ancient families of the royal lines, and also to some of the families of the Templar lines all connected, to the Sinclairs and the Drummonds. The Drummonds were the family who is Sir John's first wife, Drummond, is related to. Sir Henry Sinclair's first daughter married a Drummond, and then he disappeared and went to America.
Mm-hmm.
Very important history, but it represents their ancient Scottish Skodi line history of symbolism that goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden and Persian history with the first religions, simplistic rituals that the Templars did or were involved in. And they carried on spiritual certain traditions. The belt on the robe that represented some of this ancient history. Also, a couple other aspects with preserving this symbolism. And the same symbolism exists on that money from that ancient part of the world. And I had a wonderful gentleman, an academic who had worked on all this ancient history, and I mean biblical history, a man named Ralph Ellis, and he actually sent me images of the coins that were showing the fire pillars, proving that they went back to that ancient areas of Turkey and Iran, Persia there, which is this Zoroastrian symbolism. And so this goes back to these ancient Scythians, the history of their families that brought it over, and that's where it's always existed. So basically, it's impossible for Barton or anybody to have known this information in this relic that Scott knew about that was in his grandfather's tower, great-grandfather's tower.
Well, the fireplace, when was that created?
1620s. 1620s, they moved into the tower, him and his first wife, Anne Drummond.
So there is no way that this fireplace came long before.
The building was there prior, the tower, some years before, but when he got married, he put his coat of arms, his wife's coat of arms, and then did the tribute. So they built the fireplace themselves.
Was that 1620, or was that before then or later?
About 1620, somewhere around there. I have to double-check
well,
so many numbers.
Well, my point was there's no way in the world that the fireplace came after the seal that was put on. This was 1780, 81 when the second committee.
Yep.
So there's no, you know, that's to me is a real important point. So why in the world would that be on an altar? There's definitely has to be some kind of a connection here.
That perspective. It's just flat proof, the truth of it, because there's other hidden images inside of this one image. It's in all of those proposal designs. They're so sophisticated. You had to be beyond skilled learning this art when you're probably 8 to 10 years old. That's what Scott's apprentice was, the signer of the penman of the Constitution. His son was Scott's student. And he started at 10 years old and did the famous eagle painting that we all know about, that we talk about at the St. Paul's in New York City, the most famous Great Seal painting that no one knew who made it. I identified it. I found all the maker's marks. That's the most priceless painting with American symbolism in our country.
I just hope
no one even knows who made it.
Well, I just hope that they begin to recognize the importance of what you've done there and being able to identify these things. You have noted that in this drawing, I wanted to emphasize, the drawings within the drawings, now these are all, I don't know if you could call them microscopic, but you definitely need to have a magnifying glass, don't you?
Well, you know what? If you're holding the original ones, yes. But the government, where they do good work, the federal government, they have taken some of the greatest images in high definition and have made them available. And having that in high definition, it's easy to just bring them up on your computer and then enhance them with your own computer system, which I do. I enhance the images. And you could see everything in these things clear as day. Many images. There's many, many of these microscopic images, but not just that they're microscopic. You also wind up seeing them in large areas, like the other seal designs. We see the shield, and it looks like there's flames coming off the bottom. You turn that upside down, and here you go. Here's Henry Sinclair's Phoenix family coat of arms.
And that's the other important point here. The Phoenix. The Phoenix plays a very important part in all of this, and all of us, many of us that have looked at the Great Seal just love the idea of a phoenix, but the kind of phoenixes that we ended up seeing, or birds or eagles we saw later on, didn't look like much like the phoenix that we're looking here at this pillar, which is obvious that's a phoenix.
Exactly.
So were they trying to in any way obscure the fact that that eagle was a phoenix?
Absolutely. There's no question of a doubt. All of the first money, there were critics that had put down Scott for saying, the scrawny eagle, his work was terrible. Well, these people don't know anything about his work. I don't care. The best coin specialists don't know anything about his work. This art is specifically designed to represent that ancient history of those families and where sovereignty and everything came from. So he did a manipulation, this hybrid art. And that was the purpose, because he wanted to capture the truth of where our sovereignty had come from. And you have this phoenix representing sets and groups of these ancient royal families. Then you have the pyramid on the back of the seal that represents the other part of the ancient family's history going back to Skoda, an ancient knowledge also coming from both places of Persia and Egypt. Mm-hmm. So that's what we see here, Persian here. So if we wound up having the pyramid, you got a Persian symbol here for the Scythian history, and then you wind up having the Egyptian history to show the ancient Skoda, the princess, of her history, heritage of them founding Scotland, their children.
Could you tell us a little bit more about, we got about 10 minutes left tonight. Yeah. No, 9 minutes? Five. Oh, well, now you can see how, friends, you're going to see how it's important to do a series of these shows. Because I find this information so important, in especially now with our country literally falling apart, and it is.
It is falling apart.
And the symbols hold things together. Symbols are another level of consciousness, and that's the reason why I've spent so many years in my life studying it, and I'm just so happy that others have been able to take this so much further, because their knowledge, Gary's knowledge, in these particular areas is far superior to mine. So I've been reading and learning from him, even though at first, when I first saw this, I thought, oh my God, I don't see how in the hell this is all going to fit together. And besides, I'm doing 4 books and 500 other things, right? But it's that important that I had to stop my other stuff just to make sure that this was covered, because I am dearly afraid. I wear a hat, and my hat on it says basically, join or die. That's what I'm concerned about with this country. Our country is dividing in so many different ways. And if we do not join, this nation will fall apart. Right now, we have in this state right now, Gary, there's a part of Maryland that wants to secede from the other part of Maryland. We have states like Texas, some parts of Colorado, California, want to secede. It's just the beginning of the possibility of our losing this republic. And I'm sure Gary understands this. And this is the reason why we really bonded, because when you watch our nation being destroyed, then you've got to do something about it. But unfortunately, those who are destroying it also own the airwaves. And that really makes it much more difficult to stop. We got a few minutes, Gary. I want you to talk, and then when you come back another time, we'll continue on with this journey, because this is an important spiritual journey that we're working on here.
It is. It is. And, the one thing I want to say to the audience that is listening, this is so powerful, the information associated to this. And you have to understand, yes, it's old history. How does it do anything or relate to anything? This is the blueprint of the history to all the royal and ancient families. This is the last thing, this information the United States government has to keep themselves alive. If they do not use this information and go after the relics and re-identify this history with what they have nothing left. This is the last foundation, is the identity of the United States. And these are the people that created the banking system, art, printing, books, education, academics. The list goes on. Even the liberal world, they created it. And this is the truth. These were the smartest human beings. They had more colleges in Scotland than any other European country for hundreds of years. Very important people that had kept great knowledge. But the important thing is here is that this information can be used in a domino effect where multiple treasures, since I don't believe we have golden repositories, we have these many treasures in the United States that are devalued. I've seen $100 million flags that I've worked on worth $100,000. I'm the only person to find the only stars and stripes of the American Revolution, and I've seen this happening with everything devalued worth nothing. And this is, in Europe, it's even worse. It's even worse with their national treasures.
Mm-hmm. It is.
This is the last blueprint, and I'm telling the United States government, this is the last thing they have if they want to save themselves from tragedy. And it's coming. This storm is coming.
And
something here, and it's that important,
and
that I believe will help the people and this country to prevent what is inevitable if they do not wake up.
Indeed. I think they're going to have to wake up sooner or later, because if they don't, then the history of this nation's through. And I think that's the reason why it's important for the origins. Let's go to our origins, find out what happened there, not being dependent upon all the crap about the Illuminati. And it is a bunch of crap from that standpoint, that it is trying to take over the world, and it's the Freemasons. The Freemasons had nothing at all to do with the Illuminati. They haven't got that kind of power. They have no desire to take over the world and run it. And all of that foolishness has just wasted our time and wasted our minds. I think I've carried this a little bit too far from this standpoint. And I think we got to say goodbye there, Gary.
Bob, thank you for having me here. And you're correct. It is, the Illuminati history is baloney. Do not buy into it. There is a history here that will teach you. But the thing is, it can be a scary history because these people, they did far worse to themselves than what is going to happen to this government in the future if they do not change their course of action and wake up and make things better.
Well, we look forward to your joining us again in the months to come. Because as I said before, it's going to take a series, maybe four or five shows or so, to go through it. Because at least I would like the state of Maryland to be able to grasp this. I can't communicate to the people in Baltimore because the media in this town will not let me. I can communicate through the rest of the world media, but, but that's not, you know, many times both of my wife and I want to make sure that at least our home state at least takes a look at this information. And it's quite ironic that we've been prevented from doing that. So thank you very much, Gary. Greatly appreciate it. And congratulations on breaking new ground in this particular area.
Thank you so much, Bob. Bless you.
Yep. Thank you. And oh, by the time when we return, Janie Hendricks is going to rejoin us. And as a matter of fact, the Experience Hendricks Tour is going to open in March and March 30th in Washington, D.C., which we'll be hanging out and seeing her then.